My Family Recipe is a new podcast from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network, bringing you cherished heirloom recipes and the stories behind them. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for joining us on this hour of Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro. On today's show, we are embracing the breadbasket of America. Agriculture is the industry responsible for putting food on our tables, and it's also an economic engine for many parts of the Midwest. Ag organizations across the country support the efforts of generations of farmers to develop leadership skills, learn new industry practices, and provide a sense of community. We are lucky to be joined by some great guests representing three of these groups. Brett Evans, a supervised agriculture experience education specialist from the Future Farmers of America, or FFA, shares how the FFA is empowering youth and training more than just future farmers. Mike Anderson, a program specialist with the Iowa 4-H, gives us a front row seat to the work of his state's 4-H organization. But first, let's welcome Amanda Rosanna Rios, the Director of Membership, Leadership, Development, and Communications with the National Grange. Amanda, we're so happy that you can join the program and tell our audience about the National Grange, something that I don't know a lot of folks, particularly outside of rural America, are familiar with. So first and foremost, thank you for coming. And let's jump right into it. Tell us, what is the National Grange? How to get started?
It's an interesting story, especially considering our time and our climate today. Just after the Civil War, one of our primary founders was tasked with going through the South and doing basically an audit of what was happening with the agricultural landscape there, because we knew we had had a lot of farms burned and, destruction and things. And the government wanted to understand how we were going to feed our people, And in doing this, they sent a man, Oliver Hudson Kelly, who was from Boston originally, but by way of Minnesota at that point, to the South. And he got just the reaction you would assume, which was, boy, carpet bagger, you don't need to be here. And there was a lot of hesitation to let him onto farms or let him do the work. But he was a mason, and he had a lot of ties having this Masonic background, where he would go and meet other masons in these towns and say, I'm a mason. And they would immediately introduce him, to their friends or fellow farmers or whatever. And when he went back to DC, he talked with several other folks who were kind of influential in different organizations like Masons and Odd Fellows, as well as in agriculture, William Saunders, who was at the botanical at that time and had helped set up a bunch of different things in agriculture in DC. And he said, I think there needs to be a farm fraternity. There's 75% of the nation that's farming. And if we are going to bring the nation back together, we are going to find a way to bridge this gap, it should be through a fraternal organization. And so he and these seven men, six other men, and his niece, Carolyn Hall, who as soon as she heard he was doing this, wrote to him and said, if you are going to make a fraternity for farmers work, you cannot have it succeed if you do not include women. And however she persuaded these seven men, 1867 rolls around, they unveil this grange, that the Grange of the Order of Patrons of Husbandry, this fraternal organization, with women equally included in not only like voice and being able to go into the meetings, but actually there's four offices that were retained just for women, created just for women, so that women couldn't be excluded and put maybe just in the kitchen or whatever.
Do you know the argument that, for including women in an organization related to farming?
I do. And there are a couple of strands of this. One, women on the farm are doing more than just sitting at home, you know, crocheting all day. Typically, farm women, especially once you get past the Mississippi at this point, mm-hmm. we're putting in just as hard slogging hours, you know, in the fields or in some service to making that operation work. Sure. You know, they're going out and helping birth cows and, you know,
kind of the image that we conjure up when we think about modern or the, you know, rugged pioneer woman almost.
Right. Right. And these women were making decisions for their families in a lot of cases, especially after the Civil War. You've got a lot of farms that, whether by deed of property, are being run by women or owned by women, are being mm-hmm. run by women. And the part of the Grange that talks about this fraternalism and this raising the quality of life standard for all farmers at the time has to include these women who, all of the people on these farms, because of the tracts of acreage and the distance to town and things like that, are suffering what we know today as isolation.
Right.
And so if you're going to have this thing that these men can go to, when there's already things for men to go to, and you're going to continue to exclude women like the tradition of everyone else, it's just not going to work well, because you need that group there. And then the final part, I think, was, and again, this may fall back into a little bit of gender roles, but we know that the farm kids become the farm owners. And we know especially that young men and women work on farms in ways that we don't work in industrial society at early ages. Right. And so there is this teaching and learning that's happening daily. And the Grange had as a big component education and really progressive ideas about science and technology in farming make things easier and more profitable for those farmers. And so the kids, you know, at age 14, you can become a member of the Grange. That is something that still remains today, a full voting member. But the kids were welcome in those halls oftentimes, or at least to go to and from the meetings. They may not be in the halls. And they're hearing some of the things that mom and dad are hearing and learning about working a farm better, doing this job.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about how the Grange is very reflective of a lot of the values that are core to American society and relevant to some of the challenges that we're facing today. And, you know as well as I that, you know, oftentimes rural communities are maybe stereotyped as being homogeneous and not having a lot of, you know, ethnic, cultural, or racial diversity. But that's not always the case. And just as the Grange was ahead of their time, so to speak, with including women as equals in their organization, it's my understanding that, you know, African-Americans, Black farmers were also involved early on. That's an important story to tell. What can you tell us about that?
So you're right. Grange, from the very beginning, was this progressive organization that we don't think a lot about where you would have integration, not just in the genders that we talked about before, but also with racial equity and making sure that there was inclusion of farmers who, you know, were of color or native farmers. And in our documents, when we go back, we can find writings from our founders to a group of Black farmers from Mississippi who were looking to start something very similar to Grange, looking to start a labor group or some type of fraternal social order for sharecropping and Black farmers at the time. And while the founders' writings, you know, certainly say we're welcome to talk to you a little bit about what Grange is like and how we've navigated some of this, you're always welcome here. And the money where their mouth was, they meant it. There were Grange chapters that were predominantly, but not always exclusively, Black in Kentucky, in Minnesota, and in various places, especially various places in the South that you would not have expected an integration that happened. And then there were, from very early on in our history, Hispanic Granges, predominantly in Texas, where you find, obviously, a lot of Hispanic folks, you know, because it was Mexico. I mean, Texas was not always in the U.S. And you find Native American farmers before we had the Dakota, you know, the Dakotas as they are now, you had the Dakota Territory. Before you had Oklahoma as it is now, you had the Indian Territory. And we have tons of charters, you know, and if you look at the names, you can only extrapolate that these were Native farmers. So it's interesting to me that while Grange has certainly a larger cultural presence in the white community, and there are definitely more white members across the board in our nation or in our national Grange and in our Granges today. And there were, I think that is so often overlooked of how truly they meant anyone of good moral character is welcome here.
Well, obviously it's changed over the decades and centuries. How would they get this information that they would, I would assume, disseminate in their Grange halls and the meetings?
First of all, agriculture is one of the biggest citizen sciences, as I like to call it.
Mm, I like that.
We learn by doing, and we are not trained biologists or geologists or ologists of any sort often. I mean, it wasn't until Grange and other organizations or other entities really pushed for this, you know, land grant college system, that there was a type of, you know, institutionalized training. So if Bob had a good crop in 1872 and he had happened to use a different type of fertilizer because it was available to him, you know, he took chickens on his farm for the first year, in bulk, and he's using the chicken waste as fertilizer, for example, in one section of that field, and wow, it did twice as well as my other stuff, he would come and talk about it. So the citizen science model was certainly there. And then you have a local Grange, and then you have what's called a Pomona Grange, which is the collection of Granges in that region or that county who would meet fairly regularly. And then you have the state Grange, and then you have the national Grange. And at every single one of these levels, there are 13 officers who are elected. And one of them is called the lecturer. And their entire duty is at every meeting, be prepared to provide something educational or entertaining. And most often, if you look at a lot of these records, they were bringing something very backyard educational. So they had gone to the Pomona meeting, or they'd gone to the state meeting, or they themselves were involved in something that, you know, had exposure outside of Grange to other, you know, farms or things like that. Maybe they were a seed seller in their professional mm-hmm. life or something. And they would come in and be able to talk about this because there is a reserved space in every meeting. And that model just seemed to really work. But then when Grange really got involved in this land grant college push and in seeing, you know, education embrace agriculture and the higher ed level and things like that, it was some of our members, and I'm not saying, you know, it may have just been happenstance, but it was some of our members who created FFA and created 4-H. And if you look at FFA, sure, the colors are the same as ours. Some of the symbols are the same. They don't do the same thing, and they have a amazing function. And I, you know, don't by any means want the audience to think that we are taking credit for it, but it was really neat to see that these people who had come to the Grange and found a soul and a home there wanted to see something for kids in different realms, you know, and they'd already had some of this passion stoked, I assume, in some of these Grange halls.
Sure, sure. If we were to walk into a Grange hall today, What would we experience in those meetings?
Sure. So the first thing is, you may not walk into a Grange hall. From very, very beginnings, we had halls because that's what you do, because you have a place to meet. But today there are a number of granges that exist without halls, and mine is one of them in Pennsylvania. And our members talk a lot about what it would mean to us to have a home. So we do understand the value of that. But I think that the first thing is you might find these granges meeting in your community in places that you would not have expected. But when you go into a grange meeting, there are one great thing about grange is it is grassroots and there's a structure, but there's an allowance for personalization with everything from your service projects and your advocacy to some of the way in which your meeting is conducted. There's expectations that when you walk in and you sit down, you will hear, as they call the meeting to order, not just a rap of a gavel, but somebody saying the hour of labor has arrived and the work of another day demands our attention. And oh, wow. That's the way in which we call ourselves to order. And I love that phrasing. I mean, you don't get phrasing like that today. I love that so much. Our local grange adopted that as our motto. The work of another day demands our attention.
Well, and there's nothing that's more true when it comes to than right. You know, operating in an agricultural setting where, frankly, every day is different and there are things out of your control, whether it's, you know, climate and pests and, you know, a whole host of things.
Absolutely. And you will look around the room and you will see that you have a lot of folks who are not engaged in agriculture in the traditional sense. They may be engaged in food service or food delivery or something related to agriculture. But then there's people like me. Now, I guess I'm engaged in agriculture because I'm part of the Grange, but who didn't grow up on a farm and have never been actively involved in agriculture. But like, I really like growing my own plants. But more than that, I really like knowing where my food comes from. I like knowing my producers. I like when the store shelves were bare in the pandemic last year. I was not as worried because I knew where to go if necessary. And so you will find a lot of folks in that room who the language of some of the rest of the stuff may not escape them, but may not make that profound of an impact. And they will get their meeting off with the typical roll call of officers and secretary's minutes and the report of the secretary and treasurer. But then they will go into things like the lecturer's program, which today sometimes is agriculture related, sometimes is related to things that are really important to rural Americans, who we know are on average older, who we know on average are sicker, who we know on average, you know, tend to skew, you know, in various directions. And so you might find them instead of reporting on what's going on with the farm bill, or how to grow a better crop of beans, talking about a new Medicare expansion issue, and what the Grange has to say on that policy. Because our policy and our focus, fairly soon after the Grange really got off the ground, within about the first 25 years, started moving to people involved in agriculture, not just active farmers. And then not too long after that, to this rural community, because we realized that, you know, it does take the farmers, wife, husband, whatever, spouses, whatever it is, to run a farm. But it also takes somebody in town to run the post office and somebody in town to run the next thing. And what they are experiencing living in rural America is obviously the same as what the farmer is experiencing in lack of services or, you know, some type of inequity. So they were pretty quickly welcomed in as well. And so you'll find a lot of these folks sitting there learning about issues that are not just agriculture based. Typically you're going to find a potluck either at the beginning or the end. And I think this can't be overstated as an important element of Grange, because we are from day one, a nonpartisan organization.
Yes.
Who does not endorse candidates, who really relies on, even in some of the language that we remind people of as we do the closing, that the president of the organization will say each time, to be quiet, peaceful citizens, which really translates today into being civil to one another. And those potlucks, those times where we just argued about whether or not Medicare should be expanded or whether or not term limits should be a thing, or, you know, whether or not the the local school should encourage masking of kids. I mean, this is, again, everything that you're dealing with in your rural life. We could have had a terrible argument, but we go sit down next to each other. And I think that's also part of why Grange is important for not just farm families to be engaged in, but anyone in that rural community to be engaged in, because you're getting a perspective of life that is not yours. You're balancing it with the life that you live, the worldview that you have. And at the same time, you're learning why the human next to you is a human you can like. You're getting down to that very basic level of everybody eats three times a day, mostly. And you know, everybody needs this fuel to propel them forward. And so I think if there is one thing that I really like to make sure to say to people is, make sure at the end of your Grange meeting or the beginning of your Grange meeting, you are upholding that tradition of the potluck, because you will find the humanity in the world in the time that you spend sitting across the table from someone.
If someone wants to learn how to learn more about the Grange or to join the Grange, because as you've just described, you don't necessarily need to be involved, you know, directly in the agriculture sector. How could one do that?
Sure. So obviously our website, nationalgrange.org, is the easiest place to go and to see us in action. I think you see better representation of what local Granges are doing through our Facebook page, because we're able to share a lot of the information that they share or on our National Grange Community Service group on Facebook. But we are definitely interested in connecting individuals with their local Granges. It's something that anybody can reach out to me at membership@nationalgrange.org or even my phone number, which I make very public at 301-943-1090, to find out where the Grange is close to you. But we are going through a period that we have never experienced before. I mean, I thought 4 or 5 years ago that we look similar to 1867, but you combine 1867 and the pandemic of 1918 and squish them all together with maybe like the Depression era. And that's what we're looking at today, just in terms of what our people are facing, right? And so we are looking to bring Grange chapters to communities because I think our members believe that this model is necessary in order to do exactly what our founders set out to do, which is find ways to connect communities, bring people together, allow them to talk, allow them to get back to the essentials of the food network, of the local shop owners, of sustainability and resilience of your community. Because while absolutely having all of the national options, the benefits of, you know, being a great and strong nation are available to us because we live here in America, we won't live in a great and strong nation without great and strong hometowns. And so I really encourage anybody, if you go onto our website and you go to our Find a Grange and you don't find a Grange near you, or if you know that there's a Grange in your hometown, but you know, you are potentially interested in joining and doing new things, to reach out to me, because we are actively expanding right now with communities that are interested in seeing us in Missouri, you know, in Kentucky, in Alabama, in Mississippi, in New Mexico, in places that we have had Granges in the past but haven't had them in a long time, or Utah and Hawaii, where we've never had Granges, the only two states in our nation that haven't. Yeah.
Well, I thank you for sharing that information. And P.S., that was not paid. This is not a sponsorship or a plug. This is important information, because a lot of people have never heard of the Grange. And I think if they, you know, became more familiar with the mission and the activity that the Grange does, as you just said, at a time like this, they really might get interested and in getting engaged, because like you just said as well, strong country is based on strong hometowns. And that starts with one community organization at a time. So thank you. Thank you so, so very much, Amanda, for joining us. And hopefully we'll have you back.
Good food is worth a thousand words.
This is Aarti Menon, and I'm delighted to share a new podcast with you, My Family Recipe, from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. Adapted from Food 52's much-loved column of the same name, the My Family Recipe podcast will bring its pages to life. Each episode of My Family Recipe brings you a cherished heirloom recipe and the story behind it, from voices across the world of food.
We'd open these tubs of dough and they would exhaust these incredible yeasty fumes, and it just smelled like nothing else. It was so intoxicating.
I'll interview writers and chefs, parents and children, about what's passed down along with the foods that we know and love.
Chinese people aren't like born with a download on how to like velvet chicken. You know, like that's not something that just like comes to you.
Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Eat Your Heartland Out. We are now joined by Brett Evans, a supervised agriculture experience education specialist from the Future Farmers of America. Brett, thank you for joining Eat Your Heartland Out. I am really happy to have you on to tell our audience about the Future Farmers of America, or FFA. Now, for me, and maybe for others, you know, we associate the FFA with those blue jackets with the emblem on the back and the state name on the back. And, you know, I recall seeing, you know, all these groups of kids, you know, down on Capitol Hill from different states visiting their congressmen and their senators with FFA. And then later on, you know, really understanding the role that FFA plays in, you know, getting the next generation of people that make our food trained up. So that's my little recollection, but we know the FFA is so much more, which is why you were on the show today, Brett. So why don't we just start off with you giving us a little bit of insight on how the FFA was formed.
Okay. So first of all, the name of our organization is now the National FFA Organization. FFA still does stand for Future Farmers of America, but in 1988, so that we could better reflect the broad scope of agriculture, we made the official name the National FFA Organization. The Future Farmers of America started in 1928. It was started in conjunction with the Kansas City Royal Stock Show. For many, many years, that stock show had been inviting livestock judging teams from around the country to come and compete at the stock show. And I don't know all the details, but it originated at the Muehlbach Hotel, and there is still a big plaque, as in like 6 feet by 6 feet, on the side of the building where that hotel used to stand in Kansas City, mm-hmm. downtown. Commemorating that the National FFA organization was started there by a group of farm boys, and it was only boys, and the blue jackets didn't exist yet, but they came together, and their original purpose was to help especially take rural youth, farm boys, the way they put it, and give them some experiences in cities and in travel. Mm-hmm. And to increase their skills in production agriculture. Over the years, of course, we have greatly expanded. Women joined and greatly enhanced our organization. Originally, there was also the New Farmers of America, which was another organization for African American students, though FFA was not a segregated organization. There was that separate organization, and the two also joined, and I believe that was in 1969. So we've just continued to grow. Last year, of course, we're looking at membership numbers before the pandemic. FFA was at a record high number of members. And over the course of all the interesting year we all had last year and the difficulties at schools, we took a little dip, but I think pretty much everything in education did.
Right.
But that's one thing I'm many people are like, oh, you know, has your organization been decreasing or, you know, shrinking with the changing world? I'm like, no, it's continuing to grow and we have more and more people to feed. What could I maybe?
Well, so tell me then, why do you think that the FFA is growing? What do you attribute that to? I mean, outside of, as you were saying, more people, there's more people to feed. But there is this perception that, you know, people are leaving the farms, people are looking for other opportunities, you know, small farms are going by the wayside and those sort of things.
So I think that's a great question. And this is my own opinion, but I would attribute it to a couple of things. First, there's been a real awakening in the last few decades of people wanting to know where their food comes from, what's its impact on the environment, where, you know, the production methods, what's in their food. All of these things have helped people realize that the food doesn't just spontaneously appear on the grocery store shelves.
Right.
And I believe the last statistic I heard is that most of our population in the U.S. is 3 to 4 generations away from the farm. So there's kids growing up now, a generation. I'm 2 generations off the farm.
Mm-hmm.
As far as an actual production, my father did work on a cattle ranch, and my grandfather owned one. But I am a full generation from ever having been raised in actual production agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
But so we have so many people that are starting to wonder, where does all this stuff come from? And then, of course, the news is filled with, you know, don't eat this, do eat that. This is dangerous. This is good for you.
Right.
And the impacts on the environment. Farming's good. Farming's bad. Farming does these things. And so all of those spark an interest.
And yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, people, you know, when you put it in that context, it really does make a lot of sense given the trends that people are looking at, you know, whether it is trying to figure out where things come from, what they consume, you know, this sort of farm-to-table movement, being concerned about, you know, pesticides and climate change, you know, you name it. And all of these things do I think, spark a curiosity, that's for sure.
The other thing I would say absolutely contributes is FFA has always been a very growing and dynamic organization in that we change. If we were still an organization that was only interested in taking rural farm boys to the city to see the sites, we would have been dead a long time ago, obviously. As agriculture has grown from, you know, a large portion of the population being in some form of production agriculture to less than 2% now. But the realization is that there are more and more careers in agriculture and everything mm-hmm. from, you know, if you want to go on the organic side to the ultimate in genetic manipulation and everything in between. The environmental impacts, how do we mitigate? How do we enhance the environment? How do we help produce more food on less space? Making sure that it's all sustainable and healthy. And those things are of incredible interest. Students who are interested in science, students who are interested in public policy,
mm-hmm.
Students who are interested in public speaking and in hands-on learning. These are all things that agricultural education, which is, of course, where we stem from, provide in the schools. Agricultural education and FFA is part of that. Our biggest thing is hands-on education, that rather than just showing it to you in a book and lecturing to you about it, we're going to get your hands in it and your nose in it and let you experience it. And I think that is something that students are really seeking, to have that, and not just watching it on a screen, but to actually, you know, stick your hands in the dirt or grab the animal or pick up the microscope, and investigate these things in their classrooms.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, there is, you know, so much opportunity there for personal growth, you know, those critical thinking skills, those problem solving skills, those team building skills, you know, it really, you know, having that experience, you know, can't be replicated, like you said, on a screen. One thing that really surprised me that I believe you had mentioned to me before off air is that FFA and the agricultural education programs aren't just for rural communities and rural school districts. Some of the largest urban school districts in the country have big FFA chapters. Isn't that right?
That's correct. There's a very, I don't know if it still is or not, but at one time it was the largest chapter in the United States is in downtown Chicago. I've actually visited that school. There's another chapter, at least one, in New York City itself. And those chapters, especially because of the agricultural science ties, but again, they want to know where their food comes from and where it's produced and all of those things that we've just talked about. But very, very much, again, FFA would not exist if we were only, if we'd continue to stay only in very rural school districts, you know, we wouldn't have the appeal. And we wouldn't be able to reach the broad class and cross sections of people that we do now.
Sure. And, you know, the supervised agricultural experience that SAE that you lead up is a key component to the education programs that FFA puts on. Tell us what a typical student who would participate in the SAE would experience in the supervised agriculture experience.
Sure. Yeah, now you're really into what I do for FFA, so stop me when I get rambling here.
Oh, but go for it.
So we call it our three-circle model. In order to be an FFA member, you must be enrolled in a course of agricultural education in the high school. So every student who's enrolled in an agricultural education course, part of that course is they are required to have a supervised agricultural experience. We shorthand that as our SAE or their kids' projects is what we typically call them.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal there is we teach it in the classroom. You go out and you experience it on your own in a real world or at least very closely simulated version of owning your own business or working for someone. So we're just as interested in entrepreneurship as we are in creating employees. And so students have, they have things that range. Let's put it this way. We have an award system that I run that's meant to recognize SAEs. And there are 45 different categories.
Oh, wow.
They range from agricultural communications, which the conversation we are having, we have opportunities for students to be in the print, broadcast, radio, blogs, any kind of media where they're working with agriculture, where they're telling the story of agriculture, educating people about agriculture. So that would be agricultural communications at the top of the alphabet for us. We work our way all the way down through the stereotypical things, beef production, dairy production, equine, swine, sheep, and mixed in there, environmental science, wildlife management, vegetable production, specialty animal, which can be ranges from llamas at the big end down to crickets and insects and exotic fish.
Yeah, I feel like I heard a story about crickets and rats in Utah?
Yeah.
Can you share that story?
So, yeah, I worked in for many years in the state of Utah. I was a state director there. We had a chapter. And, you know, when you're studying animal science, one of the things you're studying is genetics and breeding and how does mutation occur and all those things. Well, in large animals, that takes years and years and years to, you know, a single cow or a pig is going to live multiple years. And so it takes a long, long time to see those things happen. Well, this chapter is in I wouldn't say urban, but very suburban area that's rapidly becoming urban. They had a school shop. They had a young teacher move in who wasn't super interested in welding, but was very interested in animal science. And in order to teach those same principles about you know, nutrition and care for animals and all, and keeping their needs so they grow optimally, they started off with crickets. And you can produce multiple generations of crickets very quickly. And you can see that if you take a spotted one and a stripy one, and I'm making things up here, but and you breed them together, you know, do you get a checkerboarded one? Obviously, I'm being facetious, but they really can see those kind of things very quickly. Can they make the legs longer? Can they, and all simply through selection.
Wow.
That grew to then, well, what do we do with all these crickets? Well, I think it was a student had a snake that they didn't want anymore and brought it to the school for the teacher because they had a terrarium. And the school began, this chapter began breeding ball pythons. And they, well, of course, then they needed to feed them. And then they started breeding rats and mice. And all of these, of course, in very controlled circumstances. But these students can have the same experience of animal husbandry and animal science, but they're using, you know, what was a school shop and a greenhouse instead of a big farm. And
that's one heck of a creative slash gross, in my opinion, way to go about it. But I, you know, I wanted you to tell that story because it's so reflective of the way that, you know, FFA and these educational programs can adapt and evolve, literally and figuratively, you know, into sort of the needs and interests and of individual communities.
Yeah, it's been, I've seen some incredible stuff about, you know, how teachers will find what they have, what they can and can't do in an area, and how they will teach principles in new and exciting ways. I've seen it done with fish. I've seen it done with, instead of growing fields of corn and wheat and barley, they're growing herb gardens in windowsills. But they can always teach these principles just with doing smaller and different things. And there's a great place. We have chapters that have farms that the school owns an orchard, or the school owns a land lab, or the school owns barns and livestock facilities. And those are wonderful too, but not, you know, obviously that's not going to fit in downtown New York.
Right. Yeah, no, that's definitely, you know, again, you're adapting to the environment and the needs of those students. Now you also do competitions, right?
Yes.
As part of all of this. Give us some examples.
So again, what I mentioned earlier was we call our agricultural proficiency awards. And on those, a student is basically they're reporting on what they've done in their SAE project. To be very competitive at those, you need a bare minimum of 2 years, and you're better off with 3 to 5 years. And it's a written application that they're reporting their finances, they're reporting the things they've learned. We have a list of skills which have been defined for agriculture education, and these are the ones that I've learned, and here's what I've done in those areas. This is my business, or this is my employment. And so that's an application process. And we had about 1,300 applications this year. We just finished. In fact, we're in the final stages of declaring winners this week. So that's one area of competition. My peers, we have an agricultural science fair. She just finished going through somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 agri-science fair project applications.
Wow.
And again, these are all filtered up to us. So this isn't how many there were. This is how many won at a chapter level and then at a state level to then filter up to us at the national level.
Right.
Another area of competition is the National Chapter Award. And this is rewarding chapters for their community involvement and the things that they're doing to grow their members and grow their community. My other peers here have 26 different competitions.
Oh, wow.
And those range from parliamentary procedure. It's one of the things FFA is known for, actually, is for teaching parliamentary procedure. And those students actually are in teams, and they're given a subject, and they debate it and pass the motions, and they're judged on how they correctly handle it and how intelligently they handle it.
Well, we need to elect more former FFA into the legislatures and higher up. I can tell you we need more of those people that understand parliamentary procedure as a former elected myself.
So, well, I'm certainly not going to disagree with you on that one. and then, of course, there's traditional competitions, judging livestock, judging crops. But even those have evolved from, instead of simply looking at a class of animals and ranking them, to, okay, here's all their breeding records and here's what we want. You know, here's the goal. How would you accomplish it? Here's they'll give them scenarios. Other competitions include food science and technology. Mm-hmm. Students actually are given a list of, here, I'm the customer, and I want a product that has this much shelf life, that falls in this cost range, and will feed this many people, and here's your ingredients. And the students have to take that project to develop a food product, market it, package it, and explain how they would get it from, basically from the farm to the grocery store shelf. Prepared public speaking, extemporaneous public speaking, mm-hmm. Environmental science and natural resources is a huge competition. Forestry, they're actually, going in and assessing not only the health of the forest, but how would we harvest timber? How much timber is available? How do you reclaim that ground? How do you make that sustainable? Oh, let's see.
You're right. I mean, you could go on and on, and not in a bad way. I mean, like, I don't mean to cut you off, but I am just blown away by the amount of, of projects and the complexity and the variety that the FFA programs offer to students. I mean, and they really are preparing students for, being future leaders, not just future farmers. Before I let you go, because we are running out of time, is there anything that you'd like our listeners to know, particularly those who are not, maybe they're hearing about the FFA for the first time? What would you like them to know about the organization?
So I would say this would be my big plug. If you have students, if you have young people that are going to be educated, and you want them to have real-world applicable experiences in science, in public speaking, in living, that there are agricultural education programs, over 10,000 of them around the country. And it's not just, this is our old saying, it's not just sows, cows, and plows.
I love
those,
that.
Those are super important, and they're part of what feeds us. But there's so much more. And the other thing I would say is, if you are wondering, why am I trying to talk you into caring about agriculture, three times a day, I hope at least three times a day, you are having an agricultural experience when you eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it's important to you. Whether you want to think about it or not, agriculture is essential for your life and for our lifestyles. And whether as somebody in the agriculture industry or simply as a consumer, you need to be educated about where that essential part of your survival comes from.
Well, what a great place to end, because you're right. We all absolutely need to eat, and we also need to have respect for the land and for the farmers that bring those, produce those ingredients that come to our table every day. So thank you so much for joining us on Eat Your Heartland Out.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Our final guest this hour is Mike Anderson, Program Specialist at the Iowa 4-H. Mike, thank you for joining the program. There is no way that I could have an episode dedicated to rural organizations and youth education without talking to someone from the 4-H. So thank you for joining us.
Yes, glad to be here.
Well, you and I are very familiar, obviously, with the 4-H. You certainly more than I, seeing the fact that you are a 4-H program specialist there in Iowa. But there are a lot of people that may not be as familiar with the 4-H as we are. So provide us with a little bit of background about what the 4-H is and its history and mission.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, 4-H is the largest youth development program in the country, and I don't think probably a lot of folks realize that, but we do touch on a lot of, you know, hundreds of thousands of youth lives each year across the country. Most every state has a 4-H youth development program. It was stems from the land-grant university over 100 years ago that was established, that certain land-grant universities dedicated time to take that information from those universities out to the people, hence the word extension. So we're extending our learning and knowledge from the universities and taking that out to, used to be an adult audience, but from the 4-H world, that would be out to a youth audience. So we're taking knowledge that we have about all of our different project areas and helping youth learn about those. And so for most people that would have a history of 4-H, that they typically think of animals, livestock, some mm-hmm. of those sowing projects from when it first started. But we've really tried to branch out into, we've got a lot of different project areas, not only in Iowa, but across the whole country in 4-H, as far as photography and robotics and all those different types of projects. So we're really trying to expand that reach into new audiences and not lose our heritage, you know, in agriculture. In Iowa, we have about 23,000 4-H club youth members, and two-thirds of those are involved in a livestock project. So obviously, mm-hmm. ag and livestock is kind of our heritage and what we're still strong in, but we don't want to limit ourselves to that. So we're trying to increase marketing and outreach efforts to let youth and parents and families know that 4-H isn't just agriculture and animals. There's a whole breadth of other project areas that youth can get involved in.
Well, I definitely want you to educate us on those other areas which the 4-H is reaching out into. But let's actually start with the heritage, as you called it. Something that, you know, I certainly know going to, you know, every county fair around me in Ohio and the state fair as well. Those livestock projects, as you said, where, you know, kids are, you know, raising anything from cattle to ducks and you know, rabbits, and then selling them usually at the fair, in the junior fair, as we call it, at least, you know, in my backyard in Ohio. So walk us through, you know, a typical ag or livestock project for a 4-H club member.
Yeah, that's a big question, and that a lot of that depends on the project area that the youth is involved in. If we look at the beef animal project area, that's a long-term one. So typically, the youth right now in the fall are going out and purchasing, or if they're raising their own beef animals to show, they're purchasing those animals kind of right now in this September, October, November months for the upcoming year. So those cattle are typically, you know, 8 months old or so, somewhere in there, 6, 7, 8 months old. And so the youth are selecting those, but they're not obviously going to exhibit those until next summer at maybe their local county fair or a state fair, or some of the national regional type shows that are available for those. So the beef project, for example, is a much longer part of the year. We get into mm-hmm. some of our other project areas like our poultry project and some of those that are much shorter, like our market broiler project that we have for youth. Those kids get those hatched chicks, baby chicks, in late June, and they already exhibit those about 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks later in August at the state fair. So that's one of those kind of other end of the spectrum where that's a really short-term type project. The youth obviously are learning, you know, throughout the year and what their goals are for their project. And so it depends on the species as far as the length of time that's invested. But a lot of the youth, you know, spend their time during the summer working on those projects, no matter what it is, if it's sheep or goats or horses or dogs and those types of things. You know, summer's kind of their main focal point as far as spending time and caring for those animals, getting them ready for the fair, for exhibition. And so it does depend on the project area of how much time and obviously how much money is spent to, you know, beef cattle and some of those larger animal projects take some more investment up front to purchase those animals, whereas some of the smaller projects like rabbits, you know, it doesn't cost as much money typically to purchase a rabbit or a chicken or something like that as compared to a horse project or a steer market beef project and those types of things. So it does depend kind of on the project area that you're going to pick.
Well, you mentioned cost, and you know, this is something that I was wondering about as I'm listening to, you know, the complexity and the length of time for things like beef and swine, for example. But it's my understanding that at least in some circumstances, you know, 4-H has taken that into account and has that cost and has, you know, partnered maybe with other organizations and with producers to try to defray some of those costs as to ensure that, you know, kids aren't being left out or, you know, not able to participate due to their financial means.
Yes, you're exactly right. And in Iowa, we've had multiple counties that are kind of using that example as you laid out a little bit on some of our project areas. For our swine project is a good example here in Iowa, where we have local producers at the county level that will provide those animals for the youth. And then those youth, you know, will take turns or sign up as far as feeding those animals, caring for those animals, exhibit them at the fair. And then if those animals go through kind of an auction, the proceeds from that animal will then help to go back to the producer to pay for that, the initial cost of that animal or for feed costs and that sort of thing. So what that's doing is that's giving a lot of youth that opportunity that may live in town or don't live on a farm or an acreage that are interested in livestock projects, an opportunity to get exposed to that and be involved in animal agriculture. And we see that kind of as a big growth area, especially in some of our swine and sheep projects, meat, goats, and some of those that are a little bit less upfront investment. You get in, like I said, beef cattle, that's a pretty big, a lot more initial price to purchase one of those. And in Iowa, you know, we're the number one swine producing state, so we have a lot of pigs. And so Some of those producers are offering that opportunity, which I think it's a great experience for those kids that they realize they don't have to be brought up in the background of production agriculture and can still develop an interest in animal exhibition and showing animals. So it's a great program.
Well, it sounds, you know, there's no question, obviously, that 4-H is known for its agricultural efforts and agricultural education of youth. But as you mentioned at the top of our conversation, they're also, 4-H is doing a number of other things like in STEM and home improvement. What are you doing in Iowa that's a little bit diverse or even in other parts of the country where 4-H is getting involved with non sort of agricultural projects?
Yeah. So in Iowa, obviously, you know, we have our ag and ag related projects. But we also have some of those, you know, the personal development, that civic engagement, communication and leadership that a lot of our 4-H'ers are involved in. That, you know, through their 4-H club meetings, they learn how to speak in front of people and learn those communication skills. We still do quite a bit of our family and consumer science projects. So our, you know, food and nutrition, which goes back to our heritage as well. But that still is a strong project area in Iowa and in 4-H in general. You know, there's still a lot of youth that bake a plate of cookies or an apple pie and take to the fair. Our sewing and needle arts projects and home improvement are still pretty big projects. Probably one of our biggest projects is our photography. And so that's really, you know, increased as far as popularity and all the different things in the digital age that kids can do with photographs. And so
sure,
we've had a lot of different categories for photography. You know, back, you know, 20 years ago or less, we didn't have all the digital stuff. And so it was, you know, taking the camera and developing it in film and then using those as photos. Whereas now we can, you know, use different programs to edit and manipulate photographs. And so that's allowed youth to use their creativity in that project area. So there's a lot of, you know, our clothing and things that like that project areas that can get youth involved are obviously across the country. The STEM, which is our science, technology, engineering, and math, is kind of the buzzword, or has been the buzzword for the last few years. But within that, you know, like I talked about, our robotics project area, and then aerospace, and some of those that are involving kids in our science projects, that we can partner with schools and provide curriculum for those project areas.
Yeah. So, which reminds me of, as I've talked to a number of other organizations that are like-minded to the 4-H, and you know, everyone is kind of rooted and grounded in that agricultural, you know, heritage and education, but also learning different types of leadership skills, life skills, and that sort of thing. But also, to take it one step further, trying to come out of maybe the rural communities and going into the suburbs and the urban centers, what is the 4-H doing to expand their reach, not just from a programmatic standpoint, but like literally from like a geographic standpoint too?
Yeah, I think the one of the things that we're really trying to educate our youth is to be advocates for, you know, agriculture, but the 4-H program in general. You know, you see on TV and media and on social media about, you know, some of the states on the coast part of the country, California, and some of them where they're starting to threaten production agriculture and putting limits and new laws to limit what farmers and producers can do with their animals and things like that. And so that's one of the things that we are trying to do more with our older 4-H, you know, high school age youth, is to teach them about advocacy and issues about agriculture, to then educate those folks that, you know, didn't grow up on a farm or don't have a lot of that ag background knowledge, and they're just kind of exposed to what they may see on the news or some of the topics and angles that may not be true stories and things like that, misinformation. And so trying to add that education piece to those folks that are, you know, pretty much removed from agriculture and production, to help them understand the value of agriculture and how people use that every day across the country, and the need for farmers and agriculture, and a lot of folks, you know, where their food comes from. A lot of them don't understand that stuff. And so trying to educate that, and so they can use their 4-H background. You know, maybe they don't have a career in agriculture, but maybe they're a lawyer or a doctor or something like that, but they could still use that background knowledge and those skills to advocate and educate other people when they're out of the 4-H program.
Well, that's definitely a big reach. You're training a new generation of advocates in policy, which is definitely something I certainly understand as a someone who spent my career previously in government. So, you know, when you do, you know, help young people understand the value of advocacy, regardless of how you know, feel about whatever topic it may be, those are transferable skills that can be utilized in other ways as well. So the 4-H is providing a great deal of value added for those that participate and for their communities. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
Not that I can really think of. We're trying to, you know, continue to tell our story and work on recruitment and retention efforts to get more youth involved in our 4-H program, especially here in Iowa, as far as, you know, utilizing our school education and schools to take programs and educational curriculum into the schools and increase our reach that way. Hopefully we can, you know, get those parents that are pushing those kids to do different activities that, you know, may not be interested or the next sports star, that 4-H is an opportunity they can meet friends and partner with those volunteers and youth adult partnerships to have and learn those life skills going forward.
Well, I did not have the opportunity to participate in 4-H, but I've met so many 4-H families over the last two decades and across Ohio, and everybody that I've met has just had the most positive experience. So I would definitely, I definitely see the value in 4-H and with bringing up a new generation of leaders. So Mike, thank you again for joining us and for sharing the 4-H experience with our listening audience.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.